It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we've been hearing, last night on Capitol Hill, the House passed legislation to end the longest federal shutdown in U.S. history. The Senate approved the funding deal on Monday after 8 Democrats joined Republicans to end the stalemate. And President Trump signed the funding package on day 43 of the shutdown. Here to talk about the House vote last night and the shutdown's end is Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee. She represents Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District. Representative Moore, thanks for joining us.
And thanks for having me, Kate. So good to be on public radio.
You are one of 207 House Democrats who voted against yesterday's measure to reopen the government. Explain why you voted the way you did.
Well, Kate, this is the only thing I have as a member. It's my vote. And it sort of mirrors the vote that I cast back in September, where I was unwilling to be a standard bearer for the continuing resolution, which had incorporated provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which there was no discussion about, in particular, the advancement of the premium tax credits to prevent millions of people from experiencing 114% increases in their premiums, the healthcare premiums. It didn't address, of course, the $1 trillion hole that we left in healthcare in general, but with the Medicaid cuts and the $500 billion in Medicare cuts, it didn't address. So it was the same vote. It was a mirror vote. That in addition to that, the Senate went on to advance some very, very poison pills in the bill. I mean, there was a corrupt provision to give 8 GOP senators up to $1 million in funding, including my own senator, Ron Johnson, people who were implicated in the January 6th insurrection, to further vindicate the president from his inaction on January 6th and to just sort of erase the criminal aspect of January 6th by really providing these senators with a slush fund. And then third, it really did not address the administration's assault on Congress's power of the purse. There was not a single provision in this Senate bill that would prevent the Congress, and particularly the House and the president, from putting through another rescissions package. There's no guarantee that every single appropriation in this bill won't be snatched back by the president with the willing support of the Senate and the House.
Representative Moore, I want to circle back to last night and take a listen to House Speaker Mike Johnson right before last night's vote.
I'm going to guess for you that most of our Democrat colleagues are going to vote again to close the government, again to take food out of the mouths of families that need it, again to deny pay to federal employees, again to stall flights and cancel airlines and do all the rest that they've done. But we are not going to let them succeed in that gambit.
Was the shutdown worth it for Democrats?
Well, let me say this. It was what it was. All we have, Kate, is our vote. You know, and so in the very beginning, in September, the gambit was our President Trump's way or the highway. And all we had to express our view was our vote. And we used our vote accordingly. My constituents said it was well worth it, even though they endured some suffering.
But Republicans didn't budge with negotiation, and
exactly.
now you are back to square one on health care subsidies.
Well, I'm not going to second guess what the 8 Senate Dems did, because apparently they have different relationships with the Senate Republicans, and they feel that they have extracted some sort of promise to have it at least put up for a vote. And if and when they do, I think the American people will have an opportunity, in fact, to see who is depriving people of health care. And with regard to, you know, Representative Johnson indicating that we were depriving people of food, honest to God, we saw the president in real time fighting court injunctions to feed people, appealing a judge's decisions to feed people, refusing to deploy the emergency resources that were right there, not dependent upon the government being opened or not.
And you're talking about the SNAP benefits, even though courts ordered them to fully fund SNAP. And how quickly will people who receive SNAP food assistance benefits get payments now that the government has reopened?
Well, the president has promised that it might take some time, but there's absolutely no reason for it to take any time other than the cruelty that we have seen this president and his cohorts in the Republican Congress are willing to extract. These people were serious. The insurrection, Kate, began January 6, 2021, and it never stopped. And I guess it's hard to blame them to continue their resolve, even if it meant starving people, even if it means, you know, taking, you know, they have voted over 70 times to kill Obamacare. This is the death blow to Obamacare by not extending those premium credits. It's the death blow. There are people who will not be able to afford to continue health care. They were determined to destroy the government. And just one other point before I yield back to you, okay? $186 billion was taken out of SNAP in the so-called clean CR environment. And so people who are receiving SNAP now will find that they'll fall into a category where they'll only be able to get SNAP for 3 months in a 3-year period of time as we've changed the law. And so we have seriously withdrawn food support from the 42 million Americans who rely on it.
We have House Democrat Gwen Moore on the phone about the House vote last night ending the government shutdown, President Trump signing it into law. You know, the resolution fully funds the government only through January 30th. Congress still has to pass other appropriations bills before the continuing resolution ends. What does the road ahead look like over the next couple of months? Do you anticipate another shutdown on February 1st?
Well, I pray that we won't have another shutdown. I pray that this gives the Republicans, quite frankly, some breathing room, and it gives them an opportunity to stand up some of their false bravado with regard to caring about the health and safety of Americans. We do have folks like, for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a staunch supporter of Donald Trump, who's indicated that she even sees that the healthcare crisis is too much. 114% increase on average for Americans is too much. And so maybe this will, you know, Republicans can stand down from their resolve that you're not going to negotiate with us until the government is open. Well, the government is open. So perhaps that was the thinking of the 8 Democrats. We're now, the government is open. We're giving you the breathing room to come to some sense about how we move forward.
Well, breathing room has to mean that House members are in session. I mean, you know, the House didn't do any legislative business for the entire length of the shutdown, nearly 8-week absence. What does an empty House say about the chamber you've served in for 20 years?
Well, What it says to me is that President Trump was right. He's both the president and the Speaker of the House. You know, that he shut the House down because of his own ego and because of his own resolve to downsize the government as he has done. You know, his big threat, one of the things is that was negotiated is to return fired employees, people who were fired during the shutdown. Well, he had already fired 200,000 federal employees, doged them out, forced them out. You know, this president is determined to destroy the administrative state, as it were.
There is a growing list of House Democrats who are calling on Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to step down over his inability to hold the caucus together during this shutdown. Should Senator Schumer step aside from leadership?
I that's a rabbit hole. I'm not going down that rabbit hole. I mean, we are where we are. Okay. Here's where we are. I'm not in the Senate. I don't have any comment on that.
Okay. Let me ask.
We are where we are. I don't know. Moving the furniture around in the room, what difference is it going to be? I mean, they have control of the White House, the Supreme Court. Let me add that. The House of Representatives and the presidency. And I think that, you know, our biggest thing is to keep the public on our side. The public has agreed. The public sees who is denying people of health care. The public sees who's denying people food. The public sees who they are. And I don't want to deflect and turn this all on Chuck Schumer and make him the villain.
So that it all sounds like it goes back to what you said before, that you only have your vote.
That's all we got.
Representative Moore, thanks for joining us.
And thank you.
That is Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee, who's represented Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District since 2004. We've been talking about the end to the government shutdown, the House vote last night to approve the funding package that President Trump signed on day 43 of the shutdown. And throughout this time, Wisconsin Today has talked with our state's congressional delegation on both sides of the aisle in both chambers. You can join in with your question. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, a Wisconsin author shares his story from dealing drugs and prison to successful fatherhood and helping others.
I'm going to go through this situation and I'm going to learn as much as I can so that I can be the best that I can be when I got out of prison.
The book is called Rising Above the Odds. That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Charmaine Harris grew up in a troubled neighborhood in Racine, and he traces his path to prison for drug dealing to a rough start and bad decisions at an early age. But he set a new path, starting in a prison boot camp program, and went on to complete his education and become a mentor to fathers in Wisconsin and beyond. In 2022, Governor Tony Evers pardoned Charmaine for his crimes. And today, he is a national speaker and trainer on father engagement and prison reentry. He shares his story in a new memoir. Charmaine Harris is the author of the book Rising Above the Odds, My Journey from Pain and Prison to Power and Purpose. He talked with Rob Ferret.
Charmaine, you start your book with this painful moment. You have been arrested for selling drugs. You've got to call your father from jail and tell him about this. What was that moment like? Why did you decide to start your book there?
For the reader, I just wanted to kind of pull them in right away to what was happening at that moment. Living a life that I was living, I got caught up in those kind of situations. And so I ended up going to jail. And my father was someone who always told me, you know, to do the right thing. He had changed his life already. And I messed up. And then I had to call the person that had been trying to guide me down the right direction. And so I just wanted to make sure that was the kind of focal point of the story and, you know, the situation that or circumstances that happened after that.
Tell us some about your childhood. You talk about the north side of Racine from an early age. You see it as violent with gang affiliations. Then it very much affected your life and the life of the kids around you. Can you share a little bit about what that was like?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up Racine, north side. And, you know, as I said, it was tough. 80s, 90s era where, you know, a lot of things was happening societally. But as I mentioned, you know, some of my early memories are, you know, police sirens and shootings. And remember a young lady being killed and, you know, smelling the crimson red blood on the concrete. And it was just a tough experience, you know, going through those kind of situations and then traumatic experiences in a community where I think I mentioned in the book at the age of 11, I sold drugs for the first time. So growing up was rough in Racine, and, you know, it wasn't a whole lot of opportunity. You had to make the best of what you had.
You describe your older brother in one case, fathers in some other cases, raising kids to be tough and encouraging them to fight and encouraging them to be violent. And thinking of that, I think, as a favor, as a good thing to prepare you for a difficult life. What did that teach you and the other kids you grew up with?
Oh, man. It's something that you just learn early. It's ingrained in you that, you know, you gotta have tough skin around here. You gotta be tough, and every day a fight is possible. All of us growing up living in poverty, you know, feeling like our poverty is better than the next person's poverty. So, you know, kids getting made fun of, and, you know, we didn't have the most resources. So I always say how I went to school on the first day of seventh grade with a hole in my shoe. And I knew that was going to bring about a fight. So I appreciate my brother and all the other, you know, figures around me for showing me early. I'm talking 7, 8 years old, how to put my fist up, how to defend myself, how to fight if somebody came at me. So it's a good thing. But the bad side of it is you kind of develop some bad habits where, you know, you don't really trust nobody and you feel like everybody is out to get you.
People, I think, wonder, well, what would lead a kid to start selling drugs? And you were just talking about that a little bit. The economic opportunity wasn't there, and this looked like the way to get, you know, shoes without holes in them and things like that. From the perspective of a kid in that community, in that situation, what was the appeal of selling drugs?
Well, the appeal was the fashion, the shoes, the clothes, you know, the status. Growing up poor, you having to wear clothes from Goodwill and St. Vincent, you know, it's tough because the people around you are so bought into these brands, Nike, Jordan. You feel like you have to measure up, especially around 6th, 7th grade, where you start to have your own identity. So that was the appeal to, you know, get started. But as I mentioned in the book, it wasn't that I wanted to get started. I was going around the community asking for money for my birthday. And a guy said, hey, stop asking for money. Here, take these 2 bags of crack cocaine and sell them. That's how men make money. That's how real men make money. So that was part of the appeal too, you know, being taught those lessons, but knowing that that person was taught those lessons from somebody else and passed it down to me. And that was his idea of what it meant to make what it meant to be a man.
Now, you end up in Kenosha. There's a custody battle between your parents. They end up living close enough. You can kind of see both of them. And one story that really stood out to you, and you tell this story later when you're incarcerated too, visiting your mom and seeing the state and the struggle she was in. Can you share that moment with us?
Yeah, after the custody battle, my mom was really going through a rough patch in life. And, you know, she was in Racine. My dad won. I moved to Kenosha and I would visit her on the weekends. And, you know, at this moment, I believe the lights were off and, you know, she had candles burning and just really not doing well. And I just remember her saying it's been a while since she had ate. Not because it wasn't no food, but just because she wasn't She was depressed and didn't want to get out the bed, specifically because she lost me as her child to my father. And so I went and bought her some food. And when I brought it back, just hearing her just like enjoy the food that I bought and just love it. It was great to do, but it just hurt me inside. And I said, man, I got to figure something out. I got to find a way to help my mom.
You end up at a turning point. You go to UW-Stout, encouraged by your father. A coach in high school helped you set that up. It didn't end up sticking. What ended up falling short there and then leading you into the situation where you end up being arrested and incarcerated?
Yeah, so moved to Kenosha, had my father's support, but when I left, I already thought I knew who I was. And so there was a contentious battle between me and my father. My mother did, you know, clean herself up, end up moving to Kenosha as well. But one thing about my dad, he was big on education, so and being involved in sports. So he made sure I graduated high school, and then I went to college, UW-Stout. But while there, I just kind of felt out of place. It was a PWI, didn't really feel connected. And then on top of that, I didn't really understand how college worked. Nobody in my family before me went to college. So I didn't understand financial aid and applying for this or that. And so I made the conscious decision to come back. But the subconscious part was going back to my friends and the people that I grew up with and going back to the streets, in a sense. And I made that subconscious and that conscious decision.
Now, you end up back in that situation. We get to where we started with. You're arrested, ultimately incarcerated. Kind of a turning point for you, or one of a series, I think, of turning points. You end up in prison, but you go to a challenged incarceration program, a kind of boot camp. And that seems to be something that really got through to you. What was it about that boot camp?
Yeah, so when I caught my original charge, I did a year in the county jail first. And then I was on probation and had struggles. And if I was to mess up, I would face prison time. I messed up and then end up facing prison time. On probation. So when I went back this time, it was different. It wasn't the county jail. The county jail, you're kind of close. You know, your family can come see you whenever. Prison, you're 2-3 hours away, you know. And it's different. You know, people can't just come visit you and see you. So did 6 months in a regular prison or a medium prison, and then eventually went to the challenge incarceration program or the boot camp program. And that's where I really just had time to really develop myself. You know, we doing physical training, intense therapy for AODA and criminal thinking and things like that. And I really just bought into the program, whereas before I just kind of went through the motions. This time I told myself, I'm going to go through this situation and I'm going to learn as much as I can so that I can be the best that I can be when I got out of prison.
Charmaine, the most powerful moment in the book to me, you're in this challenge incarceration program. You're in a group therapy situation and they want all of you to share a story. And you say, you know, some guys go through the motions. You made a decision. You were going to really share a couple traumatic moments in your life. And you're crying right in front of this room full of tough guys. That really started you on the path of telling your story and figuring out what it meant to you.
Yeah, it was the first time I really been in like therapy in a sense. So it was extremely therapeutic. And as I said, I was going to get the most out of this program. And, you know, I'm one of those perceived tough guys. So part of me was just like, let's get the most out of this program and, you know, maybe I can be a leader or something. So I went up and just really shared everything. And I could barely get my words out because my tears was flowing on a piece of paper in front of me. But that started a ripple effect. Everybody else couldn't believe it. And they started or decided to start sharing their stories as well.
Charmaine Harris is with us talking about his new book, Rising Above the Odds, My Journey from Pain and Prison to Power and Purpose. Charmaine, let's get into that power and purpose. We talked a little bit about the role of your father. You become a father, and you really embrace this role as a leader, helping other dads become good fathers. What led you there?
I went through these rough battles with employment, you know, some of the barriers people with felony convictions face when they come out. But during that entire time, my girlfriend then, my wife now, was pregnant. So I knew I had to change. And so went through a process. He was born January 2nd, 2014. And it was just eye-opening. You know, I just couldn't see myself behaving the way I had. I told myself I refuse to be somebody that's not in my child's life. I refuse to have my son coming to visit me behind those walls and bars and things like that. And so as I got focused and, you know, really started to lead myself, more opportunities came for me. And then I eventually got a major opportunity with the Community Action Agency. Sorry, the Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency. And that took my career to the next level.
You express a lot of gratitude throughout the book and then in your acknowledgments at the end. Your family, of course, but one of your second parole officer, a district attorney, the judge who sentenced you but then later did a sentence modification. What did those people mean to you, the ones that, you know, gave, that saw the work you were doing and said, hey, this guy needs a second chance?
Man, it was just confirmation that I was headed down the right path. Every situation, hold on, I'm tearing up over audio.
Yeah.
Every situation that I was involved in with community support, it was just so refreshing to know that people see my change. And, you know, District Attorney Mike Gravely is on record saying, you know, people should be rewarded when they change. And so these were just consequences or me reaping the rewards for all the seeds that I had planted over the years. The boot camp program, you know, becoming a father, being gainfully employed, and then all these opportunities just started coming for me. So I'm very appreciative of them, and I wouldn't be here without them.
Now, Charmaine, something that really strikes me about the book is you acknowledge your mistakes. You don't make excuses for yourself. But at the same time, you say, hey, wait a minute, there are some problems in our system that lower the odds for some people. The book is rising above the odds. I want to look at a couple of those. You mentioned the barriers, right, for somebody coming out of prison. They're on parole. They have that felony conviction that really get in the way of some of the things, housing, employment, and more that you need to do, right, to stay out of prison. What kind of changes would you want to see?
You know, there's a lot of conversation around second chances and, you know, feeling like people who have felony convictions deserve a second chance. It's all theory for the most part, largely. But a lot of people don't actually practice it. So, you know, you got great movements like Ban the Box, where, you know, employers are attempting not to ask those questions, but that same concept can be applied to housing and property management companies. I'm not sure if you know, but you know, a person with a felony conviction or on parole will be denied life insurance. There's so many other different things, Pell grants when it comes to education, FAFSA applications, so many societal things. And so sometimes you hope that you would have a second chance, but it's not given to you, and it's something that you have to go and take, in my opinion. So that's why I titled my book Rising Above the Odds, not necessarily beating the odds, but rising above them, because they're not going nowhere, in my opinion.
Starting even earlier now with Rising Above the Odds, Charmaine, take a kid, maybe that 12-year-old kid, maybe today in North Racine, what would help them steer clear of the path you started on that led to being incarcerated?
Well, that's why I'm real big on fatherhood and people my age or older recognizing some of the obstacles put in our way. And what would stop that kid would, if his father is around, him recognizing his importance in that young child's life. If he's not there, a community of support of strong men and women, but just a community of support around him that can help him kind of dive into some of those deeper issues at an earlier age. You shouldn't have to go to prison before you get a chance to be in therapy for the first time. So if that kid could have an early intervention, 10, 11, 9 years old, it'll make a world of a difference.
You really talk about the power of words a lot, both, you know, in that Challenge Incarceration program when you share your story, when you're leading fatherhood seminars, and in this book. What do you hope that sharing your story will do to get other people to share their stories and maybe learn some lessons along the way?
Well, that's the thing, you know, as a career speaker now and, you know, being able to build a business based off my story, once you know yourself, you know, you understand yourself. And so there's a real deep dive into something called emotional intelligence. And, you know, those words, speaking affirmation over yourself, telling yourself you can do it, because the stigma of a felony conviction has both external and internal kind of consequences. So the way you speak to yourself, oh, I'm a felon, I can't do it. I'm not going to be able to accomplish this or accomplish that because X, Y, and Z. Being able to hone in your story and recognize that your story has power and you're in the power to change someone else's life. You stop living a kind of selfish kind of way and you start empowering others and recognizing that your gift can literally transform an entire community like I did.
Charmaine, thanks so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you. Keep up the good work.
Charmaine Harris is a national speaker and trainer on father engagement and prison reentry. After being incarcerated, he was pardoned by Governor Evers in 2022. He talked with Rob Ferret about his new book. It's called Rising Above the Odds: My Journey from Pain and Prison to Power and Purpose. Coming up, Grammy-nominated songwriter Appleton's Hillary Reynolds has new songs she says were too personal to give away. This album drops during her pregnancy.
Balancing the release of this album with all of the hormonal shifts and still just needing to show up.
The album Changing Seasons, that's next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
Just give it up and put it down. I know I'm calling you out.
This is the song Disappearing, about friends who don't keep in touch. It's off the debut solo album by Grammy-nominated artist and songwriter Hillary Reynolds. For years, the Appleton native has written songs for other artists and for TV soundtracks. But this collection of songs, Reynolds says, were too personal to give away. The album is called Changing Seasons, and Hillary Reynolds joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
You describe this period in your life of being in the first trimester of pregnancy and releasing a new album. It's like you said, the black hole. What has this time been like for you?
This time, I'm already a mother of a toddler, and sort of balancing the release of this album with all of the hormonal shifts and growths, you know, that are happening within, and still just needing to show up and, you know, honor my commitments and give as much love and support to the release of this album that took so long to make. I mean, it's just comical, the timing of the buildup. It was such a buildup for me internally from when we started tracking this album to the actual release of it in August, and having that fall right when I was like 8-9 weeks pregnant, and it was just the thick of the nausea and fatigue of first trimester of my second child. So it's been a little wild.
And the album, as you said, is years in the making, pre-pandemic. Along the way, you know, you've changed, you know, a songwriter changes. How does that evolution play out in this album and personally as a musician?
when I started writing it, I had, you know, kind of landed in LA. I was new to the scene. I knew I wanted to really dive deep into writing and be more of a songwriter session person as opposed to pursuing my own artistic needs. And the journey and the arc from then to now is kind of remarkable because in that time, I did write this album, did do a bunch of sessions, got some placements in TV shows, ended up writing a song that Little Big Town cut, and that album being nominated for a Grammy in 2020, and then getting pregnant and having my firstborn. It's such a time capsule for me of all of that. The chapters are really diverse, I would say, from the stretch of writing to releasing.
I did a Hooray Hillary moment when you talk about how these songs are too personal to have other performers make them their own. And, you know, kind of like don't give away your own talent and the deeply personal feelings you have in your own music. Is this a change inside of you to say, no, these are my words, they're meant for me?
I think that I went through a phase of thinking that in order to find career success, it was a means to support other people's visions and putting theirs before my own. And then I think through these writing these songs specifically, they were such good medicine for me that when that happened, I just knew they were too precious to hear somebody else sing. So I don't think I haven't always felt that way, but now I can recognize it.
Sun's coming up to shine, you're still sleeping. I've been up all night for no reason, and I can't turn off my mind. Lately I've been lost in contradictions, running wild in my imagination.
The second track on the album, Can't Turn Off My Mind, it feels like it has layers of meaning. There's the insomnia, you know, there could be the buzzing to-do list in a mom's mind. Have you found that some of these songs have transformed through time from, you know, writing them to recording them to performing them for an audience?
I think that song in particular has had such an interesting meaning change over the years. When I first wrote it, it was just more or less about my anxiety and, you know, the act of rumination in the most inconvenient times. And then becoming a mother, it did sort of open up and go a little deeper. And even last night, my little buddy had a sore throat and he woke up in the middle of the night. And for the rest of the night, I didn't sleep. I just didn't get good sleep at all because I was just wanting to make sure he was okay, you know? And I think that's just part of being a mom.
I'm thinking about the lyrics, sun's coming up to shine. You know, I've been up all night.
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of mourning, you know, these songs, you say they're good for mourning time and the routine and greeting the day. But, you know, mornings can be really hectic, especially for parents. Why did you channel the mourning in these songs?
I think I channeled the mourning because in the newborn phase, there was just so much space and not space. So to be completely honest with you, I thought that my relationship with my son was kind of like I was staring at a blob for the first 4 months. I was like, I'm not getting anything from you. I'm trying to understand you. I'm trying to read you. And it was a lot of just contact, but no communication. And so I think when this album really started to come to fruition, I was seeking classical music in the morning. I was seeking little Jane Austen moments, and I was reading through the Beatrix Potter Treasury, and I thought that this album would be a really great companion to those sort of moments.
We're talking with singer-songwriter Hillary Reynolds from Appleton about her new album, Changing Seasons. Let's talk about the title track, Changing Seasons.
Don't buy me roses that free on the vine. Leave them in the garden. We'll bring a blanket outside. We'll bring a blanket outside.
Does it set the scene and the mood for your solo debut here?
I think this track in particular for me really dives deep into the influences of this whole record. And for me, Sunrise, a track by Norah Jones on the Feels Like Home album, I just felt a kindred spirit with writing this song and channeling that warmth. And I think most of what she does is timeless. And I think that when I wrote this song with my guitar player, it was just one of those things where I felt like I could sing it for the rest of my life and it would just continue to be one of those chestnuts in the repertoire, you know? And when we came together to build the world, I just thought it was a great first track to introduce people to all of the intimate places this album can be, but then also all of the worlds that it can touch.
One of the worlds it can touch is your home of Appleton. And it sounds like growing up in Appleton was really influential for your musical journey. Can you talk about that and whether Wisconsin, you know, DNA is in your songwriting?
I definitely think it's there, for better or for worse. But I think with growing up here, growing up for me, the access I had to commercial music was really through my family. And for the longest time, my family has always had a family band, and they've played Tom Petty covers and Steely Dan and Stevie Wonder and Beatles, of course, Rolling Stones. Anyway, Fleetwood Mac, I go on and on and on. And Neil Young, of course, I need to stop. But I grew up with all of those songs coexisting in sets. And it was typically at the Wapaka Harbor Bar or a barn dance or somewhere in Door County in the summer or somebody's living room for rehearsal. And with that, I really truly thought that they wrote all of those songs.
Oh, that must have just, you probably had your heart broken when you learned that wasn't true.
I totally did. I think I was like in middle school when I started cracking the code and I was like, wait a second. This John Hiatt song, this is a John Hiatt song? I just, you know, there were so many moments like that. And I mean, to their credit, it was just, that was what I grew up listening to because that was what was in front of me. And I treasure that time. I will always treasure that time. I know it's really lucky to be able to grow up in that sort of environment, paired with having access to the conservatory here in Appleton, called Lawrence Arts Academy Girl Choir. I was part of a girl choir for like a decade. I also took viola lessons and was part of the youth symphony that was here. And I was in two choirs in the high school, like throughout high school, and in the musicals and played golf. And I don't know, I just did so much. I was really fortunate to be able to tap into so many things, but really I had such a good backbone in classical music that when it came time to going to college, I wanted something different. And so, and at that point I had been writing my own songs, and when I got a scholarship to Berklee College of Music, I was just like, all right, that's where I'm going to go. And that's where I really dove headfirst and heartfirst into writing my own songs and, you know, just getting familiar and acquainted with a totally new place on my own. So
far from Appleton, you know, Boston.
Oh, yeah.
And with so many other students around you on their musical journey as well.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about your new book, Send My Love. The dedication, your mother, Trina, was a breast cancer survivor of 20 years. And in your book, you say she taught you how to love. How does she show up in how you live your life today?
So she did not survive. She actually passed away in 2011. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way that she taught me how to love was just to love everyone. I really don't judge people through what they say. It's usually how they show up, and it's their actions and how they hug. And she taught me all of that and gave me a good sense of good people. Hmm. And just that everyone deserves kindness. So, yeah.
What advice do you have for other women who are trying to tap into their creative sides, whether it's music or something else, and be able to do it while they're also juggling, you know, the early days of motherhood?
Oof. I mean, be gentle with yourselves. I think I really struggled to navigate that time without my mom. And I think that it was something that forced me to become more resilient, but there were moments that were just really, really low. And I could tell, I knew the holes and the gaps that she would fill, and I could sense that. But I think that, like, I really did dive into soothing music, like just listening to Tchaikovsky and Gershwin songs. And I really dove into otherworldly music that made me feel like it was like Fantasia narrating my life as opposed to sitting in silence.
Hillary, thank you for sharing your music with us.
Well, thank you for listening.
That is Hillary Reynolds, singer-songwriter from Appleton. And we've been talking about her new solo album. It's called Changing Seasons. And we're going out on an instrumental version of the track Magic. We've been sampling the new album, Changing Seasons, from Appleton's own Hillary Reynolds. And let's hear from you. Are there songs that you connect to childhood, or songs that you sang to little ones in your life, or that you sing now? I know when my kids were babies, we'd listen to folk artist Elizabeth Mitchell and Rafi, Baby Beluga, and then the Wiggles from Down Under, Fruit Salad, Yummy Yummy. Share about songs that have special meaning to times in your life. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Mackenzie Crummy, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.